Tonight, then, we continue in this narrative that we're given here, the Acts of the Apostles in chapter 25, Luke's inspired accounts of these various transactions took place there, Paul being detained, of course, Jews, Roman authorities dealing with him, and he with them. And the title this evening is this, The Opposition Never Ends. The Opposition Never Ends. Felix is no longer the governor. We saw him last week, a conflicted character, on one hand seemingly drawn toward the truth that he is hearing from Paul, on the other hand hoping that there might be some bribe given to him whereby he can acquit Paul and comfort himself in doing that even if the Jews are unhappy, at least he, Felix, had finished not out of pocket as a result of him letting Paul go. But Paul gives no bribe, and Felix cannot bring himself there to find Paul guilty, because he knows that he's not, and Felix himself may have come under a fair degree of conviction of sin. And so it's been stalemate, and Paul has been left in prison 2 years. That said, the Jews, their hopes of prevailing against Paul had been disappointed. They might well have wished for something quicker than this, that it's only second best as far as they're concerned, that Paul is in some measure detained. Felix, we read last time, gave a measure of freedom to Paul, allowed people to come and minister to him, and so forth. But the Jews would not have been satisfied with that. That is only second best. Ideally, they wanted Paul dead, as we continue to see in this passage before us. But so far, they've been unable to prevail. Well, now my first heading is this. A change of governor. A change of governor. Felix has been recalled, not going with a good record to report to Caesar for his period of governorship. There have been troubles and difficulties. Something of his cruel streak had left him there, his record rather smeared, left him with a bad report to convey to Caesar. So there's been, if you will, a cabinet reshuffle, and this new figure, Festus, has appeared. From all accounts there, a better governor than Felix in that way, not marred by the same flaws of character, same degree of corruption there and cruelty as marked Felix and his time in office. Festus, though in fact only remained in office 2 years, actually died in office, had at the end of his life there a better record that was given of his time as governor in Judah. So he has come, a change of governor, a new appointee. New hope then? Are things about to change for Paul? Is this man going to alter the whole way in which things are done? Well, as we have read in Acts chapter 25, we are wise not to pin great hopes on new governments or new presidents or whatever else it might be. They come with the same baggage, new presidents, new prime ministers, new whoever they might be in office. Many of them are, as much as their predecessors, prisoners of public opinion, prisoners of different pressure groups whose demands they have to in some way meet and assuage. Festus is a wise man, at least in this regard we can say, that having only just arrived in Caesarea, only just found his way around his new residence there, the official place where the governor was, the political capital of Judah, but he knew where the real power lay, and he knew where he had to very quickly find out what was happening, who the various personalities were that he was going to have to deal with. He needed to get himself to Jerusalem, where the stakeholders, the various religious leaders, influential people who could make or break his governorship. These were the people that he quickly wanted to be on acquaintance with, have them there on speaking terms, and be able to hear what might be their demands. He'd been aware that Felix had antagonized them quite considerably, and that there had been some blood that was shed, and maybe he was eager not to repeat the mistakes of his predecessor. And so, very quickly, After 3 days, we find him going up to Jerusalem. And equally quickly, we find that the high priest and the chief men of the Jews want to bend his ear. Festus learns from them that he has in his custody in Caesarea a man, a great troublemaker, a man who's caused mayhem and furore in Jerusalem. At least that is how I imagine it was relayed to him by the Jewish leaders. Maybe those leaders spoke ill of Felix, said how badly that man had handled the case, how he had not delivered justice, how he had inflamed public opinion against him. As a hint, really, to Festus, that he really ought to do better than that, and really ought to do something there for the Jews, something that Felix found himself unwilling or powerless to do. Maybe to, as it were, G up Festus, and to make him think, well, where my predecessor has failed, I will succeed. I will cut the Gordian knot, as it were, and solve this problem. And so perhaps the high priest and the other chief men there were putting a bit of pressure on Festus, telling him how Felix had done so badly, and looking to him there to do better than that, putting some pressure on him and his governorship. So there we find the leaders there eager to have this case that has been stalled, it's been stalemated, to have it reopened. They want Paul on trial. Or rather, they want Paul to be brought to Jerusalem, because Luke tells us there is the unvarnished truth. They were going to lie in ambush, we read in verse 3, along the road to kill him. It's the same old story as it was before when they were in Jerusalem, that they had those 40 men, 40 plus men in fact, who had taken a solemn vow that they would neither eat nor drink until Paul was dead. Well, the same attitude, the same feeling is obviously running strongly through their system. So after all those years that have passed, their interest in the case has not abated at all. Almost the first thing, it seems, that they want to petition him about isn't, peace and security, isn't to do there with welfare and taxation or various things that people often are anxious about or want to speak to governors about. But it appears it's Paul. They want him sorted out. They want the governor to move in such a way, manipulate him, to bring Paul to them in Jerusalem, that on the way they could kill him. Well, Festus isn't going to fall in line with that. Perhaps he has some inkling here, maybe from Felix, but from others as well, as to the malign and malevolent intentions there of the Jews. Because instead he invites them to come down to Caesarea with him when he returns there, and that he will speedily then have the case heard before him. So we can see that nothing in a sense has changed, a change of governor, but there is apparently still in Festus's heart, as with Felix, some degree of desire to appease Jewish opinion. Because having brought these men with him down, and having sat on the judgment seat and had Paul arraigned before him, hearing the case and hearing the Jews, as Luke there pointedly says, bringing serious complaints against Paul in verse 7, which they could not prove. It has been always the same, hasn't it? They advance these great complaints against him and accuse him of all kinds of malevolent activities there, disruption and mayhem and riot in Jerusalem, and they could not prove any of it. And Paul answers there for himself, makes a very pointed case there, that he has not broken the Jews' law, he has not done anything against the temple, neither has he done anything against Roman law. He's not offended against Caesar in anything. And here in verse 9, Festus gives himself away. We learn there, as Luke, inspired narrative, seeing what was in the man's heart, wanting to do the Jews a favour, answered Paul and said, "Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and there be judged before me concerning these things?" Well, he's heard all about these things in Caesarea. He's had the same protagonist there making the accusations that they'd only repeat in Jerusalem. What need is there of a further trial? Why a change of location? Well, Festus, knowing how much they wanted to have Paul in Jerusalem, I dare say by now, seeing how heated and triggered their opinion is, how quick they are to express their ire, realizing that anything that he could do to placate them and appease them would be perhaps helpful to his governorship, asks Paul, "Would you be willing to come to Jerusalem then and to be judged before me concerning these things?" Wanting to do the Jews a favor. He wanted peace. He wanted his period of governorship, however long it would be, and in the end it was only a couple of years, as I've just said. He wanted to finish with it looking good on his CV, to be able to show that he'd managed the whole state of affairs, those troublesome Jews who are so truculent and difficult to manage, that he had accomplished something where others in his office had failed. He's wanting that kind of report. And he realizes too, perhaps so, that if there is any trouble, if a high priest and these heated people whose whole attitude there he may quickly be discerning is angry and stubborn and full of venom, that if these people really took the thing on, then he would have a lot of trouble and governing this province quietly. And he himself, the governor, well, the finger will point at him. He'll get blamed. If there's any trouble at all, he'll get blamed for it, even if really in a sense he'd done everything he could to stop that trouble happening in the first place. So he's anxious to secure the goodwill, the high priest and the ruling class, as it were, of Jewish leaders, the Sanhedrin. And so we see a change of governor, but still the same things. Felix, he was wanting to do the Jews a favor as well. He was looking to curry their favor and to try and win some approval rating from them. And Festus, though more upright than Felix, though a better caliber of governor, but still prisoner of the same limiting conditions, a prisoner of public opinion. We sigh, don't we, there? And we know only too well that temporal powers, the powers that be, can, for all of their good speeches and at times very serious and well-meant intentions, fail miserably because they're prisoners of public opinion. They are prisoners of various groups, angry groups, violent groups at times, sensitive to their views and unwilling at times to deliver justice. So we as Christians, we would say, we don't pin our hopes on governments and on leaders. They are flawed. It is vain to trust in princes. The word of God tells us not to rely on them to deliver sometimes what they have promised to deliver. They aren't necessarily going to do it. They find themselves unable to perform it because of various sections of public opinion that they will have to answer to, perhaps at an election. So change of governor, but not really much of a change of policy. And my second heading anticipates what we have in our title and what already we've said is the opposition never ends. The opposition never ends. Despite previous failure to press home his charges there, the high priest employing that orator Tertullus to go and make a case before Felix, and having had their moment in Jerusalem when Lysias, the commander, had Paul brought down to them so that he could get some handle on what this disagreement was, despite all their efforts to try to get Paul on one of their charges and failing in it, they had not given up on their intent to have Paul killed. They're eager. They've lost no energy in this. The years have not abated their hatred of him and their willingness to do him harm. As we've seen, they bent Festus's ear. One of the first things they've done as soon as he's appeared in Jerusalem, they've been petitioning him and that ambush there. Well, if those men were still who had made that vow previously ready to kill him, then Paul's life would seriously have been in danger. So Paul, they're in prison, semi-prison anyway, in Caesarea, hardly really doing any harm to the Jews there in Jerusalem, no threat to them, no great force to be reckoned with, his own liberty severely curtailed. But for the high priest, all the Sanhedrin, his very existence is still an affront to them. His very existence, the fact that he's still alive, is too much. We've been mentioning they might have at least had some degree of satisfaction that he wasn't traveling now, he wasn't in Jerusalem teaching, he was sort of a little bit out of sight, out of mind. But no, the very existence of the man was still too much for them. They wanted him dead. What an attitude that is. And that opposition, that you might have thought would have just cooled down a little bit, was still burning as strong as it was when they seized Paul in Jerusalem a couple of chapters back in the book of Acts. Well, we might say that the Sanhedrin, these Jewish leaders, were gripped by something we might term religious supremacism. Religious supremacism. An elitist thought that they and they alone, no other rival, no alternative point of view could be tolerated. That they held all of truth there and that they themselves were the very embodiment of that truth. You never have a sense of the high priest questioning his own conduct or wondering why it was that he could express such murderous attitudes and intent. No, he would rather read that as being a sign of his evident spirituality, evidence of his great zeal for the truth of God. So there was this supremacism, this idea of them and they alone, nobody else that they could tolerate within their company. Any dissenting voice had to be silenced. No rivals could be permitted. And as with so many who are gripped with this kind of religious fever, there is a special hatred reserved for those who have reneged, departed from the faith, whom they would regard there as apostates. For them, well, the worst of outcomes would be decreed. And Paul, having once been so fervent in his Judaism, so fervent in his Pharisaism, and then having gone 180 degrees around, this was to them quite unpalatable. The man was a marked man from that moment. Instantly, whenever Paul started to preach in Damascus and elsewhere, instantly trouble followed him, and there were those who wanted him dead. They wanted him out of the way. That opposition had never ended. And now here are these Jewish leaders, unable to reflect upon their behaviour, unwilling to concede that perhaps they've got it wrong, not even properly listening to the case that Paul had made, that he believes in the resurrection. And the Pharisees believe in that, don't they? And they had descended then, hadn't they, into farce, the argument and dissent. Paul was orthodox. Still, that was not enough for them. The fact that he had turned away from the traditions of the fathers, the fact that all the commandments of men that they so assiduously held to, that he had now moved from those and was now saying that one can have a relationship with God without all of these extra things there, was just too much for them. The challenge it was to their authority, the challenge to their power, and the admiration that they looked for from their followers, Paul constituted a threat and had to be eliminated. Well, we see such religions in the world today, and so often we have to refer across there. There is Islam, death to apostates, all the various schools of thought, of Sharia, teaching, all of them insist and agree that those who turn away from the Muslim faith, that they must die, that they are worthy of being put to death. And I learned that in this country, yes, in this country, there is a Christian organization that runs safe houses for people that have left the Islamic faith and who have espoused Christianity. The thought that we have to have safe houses in the United Kingdom for these dear people, well, that's a thought, isn't it? Indeed. But that supremacism, this idea that nobody who moves away from this position can be tolerated, that they must be eliminated, dismissed, destroyed. That runs deeply there. But it's not only what we might call religion in the way that we more often would understand it. There's such an intolerance, such an unwillingness for self-reflection can be found. No, we might say, equally it is a religion, we would affirm, I think, secularism, a secularist supremacism. This idea that, well, there certainly is no God, that such an idea is foolish, and that any that hold to such an idea really are not worthy of being listened to. and who take it upon themselves to try to eliminate the Christian witness, to try to have it silenced. Well, their opposition never ends either. And all the confidence that they've gained in the last couple of decades there, it now runs rampant through the internet. And so just recently in the news has been Dan Walker, a man there who first hit the news headlines because well-known in football circles there as an authority on football and what happens there, but recently appointed to a new post, helping to front a breakfast time television show. But he has said he will not work on a Sunday. He wants to be in the house of God, worshipping God on a Sunday, which first of all attracted the interest of the media. But then worse was to come. If they would allow him that and say, well, that's his choice, the fact that he was a creationist, a man who believed in six-day creation, that really set them going then. And all manner of people then weighed in against him and insisted that such a man should not be employed by the BBC if he believes in six-day creation. And so the argument has run and run. All that hatred and the intolerance of all of this. A kind of secular supremacism, arrogance that such people, at least some of them in this particular quarter, have towards Christianity or indeed any other religion. The self-belief, the idea that they are the only repositories of truth and that they are the only people who should be listened to. The way in which they've unleashed their fury against Dan Walker and did that head teacher we keep referring back to a few weeks ago is evidence of something very unhealthy. This opposition never sleeps, it never ends, it never goes away. One can read philosophers from a bygone age, their disparaging comments against the belief that there is one God. Well, some of those philosophers there had their eye upon Islam, but were very happy to group together Christianity with it and insist that it's an arrogant religion that goes forward and just kills wherever it goes. And they have sweet words actually to say about polytheism, worship of idols and things like that, as though, for instance, there the Aztec society was a happy society, they're conducting all its human sacrifices and the kind. So there have always been people prejudiced in their thinking and ready to see the worst in Christianity and try to drive it away. And so we have to reckon on this. Here was Paul. Those 2 years had passed, but the opposition had not faded. And there we are, we may at times have some rest or lull in the period of activity, but for sure there'll be some other controversy round the corner. Somebody like Dan Walker will suddenly attract their interests and set them firing off again. Or one of these wise heads will come out with a new book and the whole thing again will be attracting a lot of interest. No, the opposition doesn't sleep, it doesn't rest, because at the end of the day we have to say the devil doesn't rest. And God's people, we're always going to have to face this fact, we'll find that the opposition never ends. Well, my third heading, we have a happier ending, I must say, but our third heading develops this a little further. Christian scapegoats. Christian scapegoats. Well, Nero, it seems, blamed the Christians for the fire that burnt Rome. Ever the Christians are those that are the soft target, the easy target for some particular problem. Easy to pick on them. And Festus, it appears here, was of a similar cast of mind. Better to let Paul go to the wolves to secure his own political purposes and advantage. Ready to permit an injustice to go forward by having Paul tried in Jerusalem when the trial in Caesarea had obviously failed. It had not been able to produce any evidence. But in order to curry the favour of the Jews, well, let's send Paul to Jerusalem, suspecting perhaps that it might not turn out too well for him there, but willing to do that, willing to have Paul go to the wolves for his own political purposes. And at times we find ourselves, sadly, we feel from government, having there to keep people happy, appeasing angry people, so much easier in such a situation to punish peaceful and tolerant people. So much easier to do that when you have a group of people who you suspect you'll never be able to placate, never be able to make them happy. So in order to at least keep some degree of peace, you turn on other people instead and punish them for things that they haven't done. Festus needed to appease the Jews, the people who could make or break his governorship, who could leave his whole authority in tatters, lead to a disastrous report going forward to Rome and the end of any of his political ambitions. We fear today that we as Christians are being made scapegoats in order to appease Islam again, that the abject fear in political circles, not an ungrounded fear about what suicide bombers might do or what kinds of terror and trouble could be unleashed on British streets, means that it is very much in vogue to try to appease sections of Islamic opinion. One way in which that is done is to allay their wrath and sense of grievance by attacking the church instead and taking it out somewhat on Christians. We've seen, haven't we, it's rather a sick joke really, that these plans about Ofsted, they're going to perhaps, if this goes through, investigate churches that have dealings with children over more than 6 hours in any given week, and to see if what is being taught fits within the category of extremism. And if it does, then somehow or other those churches or meetings will not be able to teach children any longer. And the head of Ofsted, just commenting upon this whole possibility there, says, well, we've got to be even-handed. We've got to be even-handed. Even though there's no evidence that the Christian church is fomenting riot, that we're arming children to go out and become suicide bombers or anything like that. We taught them there how to make models of Goliath last week out of plastic bottles and things, but I don't think any great violent intent will follow from those. However, it seems that such possibilities cannot be ruled out. We've got to be even-handed. If it is that the madrasas are looking at likely places where people are getting some very bad ideas and antisocial ideas, but in order not to stigmatize, we're also going to deal with everybody the same, as all of them are possible jihadists and liable to create antisocial behavior. So we have seen this proposal. We're trusting there and praying, aren't we, that this will come to nothing. But in a way, this is what Festus is doing here. Implacable Jewish opinion. He can only see trouble with these people, their potential for violence, their track record does not speak well of them at all. But in order to do them a favor, let's use Paul here and let's have him put on trial, in effect to treat him as guilty, in effect to make it possible, maybe, that he'll be found guilty. But certainly at least to put him through the injury and the shame of a public trial, maybe to hope that something of the no smoke without fire hangs around him, and at least in the eyes of the Jews punctures his credibility. These kinds of machinations and calculations. Easier for him, Festus there, to maintain the peace, to have Paul used as a pawn in this whole equation and have his reputation there diminished, if needs be, in order to keep the peace. So, nothing new at all. Festus's behavior sadly reminds us of some of the behavior we've witnessed in some circles of our government here. And we have to regard it as such, that Christians are often to be the scapegoats in these kinds of situation. We're an easy target. And it's ironic in a way that we who are accused by so many of being intolerant, that they would not use the invective or the insults against us unless they banked on the fact that we're actually a very peaceful, peace-loving people, and actually a very tolerant people, that we will tolerate their insults, tolerate their jibes, tolerate their downright lies, and not come back with bombs and bullets, with swords and machetes and such things as that. That these people who accuse us of intolerance actually pay us the compliment that they believe in the end we're very tolerant people and will bear with all of their criticisms and insults in good part. Comedians, well, they've admitted they're the yellow streak that they have. Easy there to laugh at Christians. Wouldn't dare tell a joke about Muslims or Islam. They fear for their lives in that. But they reckon that we're a decent sorts at heart. Tolerant, we'll put up with their bad jokes and sick humour. And that we won't come back with them, at them, with violence. And in a sense, they're absolutely right. But we, again, as God's people, as Paul here had to learn lessons of patience and indeed tolerance and willingness there to have to see this machinations and political manoeuvrings and the Christian church, or he himself as the Apostle Paul, manoeuvred into a situation to meet some political objective. We have to bear with much of this. For now, I did say there'd be a happier ending, and it's my fourth heading, final heading, Paul's master stroke. Paul's master stroke. Through all of this, and what we read here, isn't it? It's lessons on politics, it's lessons on base human nature, the fallibility and frailty of governance. Luke bringing us through this narrative, this inspired text, but it's showing us here humankind really at their worst. But God is with his people. The promise still stands that we saw last week. Paul is going to Rome. 2 years held there. Felix, no trial, no progress, the whole thing stalemated. Yes, but Paul is still going to Rome. Felix left Paul, we read at the end of Acts 24, bound. But no, not bound, in fact. God's plan is moving forward. And Festus has come, perhaps thought himself the new broom, and is going to make something happen, and is quickly on the case, setting up these different trials and trying to progress the case. Paul, will you go to Jerusalem and stand before me there? Well, Paul has not the slightest intention of that. He's not going to stand before a corrupt court in Jerusalem, and has no interest whatsoever in ascertaining the truth, and especially there at Festus's behest, when Festus himself knows full well what the truth is. And he therefore plays this master stroke, having painted himself there, standing at Caesar's judgment seat, that is before Festus as the appointed Roman governor in verse 10. That's where the judgment should be. He's not done anything, he says, against the Jews, as you very well know. He has Festus here at a disadvantage. Festus knows that Paul's got his number, if you like. But he knows the case, he understands the evidence, he knows at heart there is no case to answer, no need for a trial at Jerusalem, no reason, in fact, to keep him bound at Caesarea, that he himself is compromised by this whole situation. So here, Paul plays this masterstroke, whether it occurred to him at that moment, or whether he foresaw this and God had already prepared what he should do. There, at the end of verse 11, I appeal to Caesar. I appeal to Caesar. The Latin word there, which was used in those days, appello. I appeal. I call. Appello. And that meant suddenly everything changed. The whole machinery of office there and of the justice system now meant that Paul had an absolute right as a Roman citizen to be heard by none other than Caesar himself in Rome. That the courts there at Caesarea and any court that he may try to establish at Jerusalem, completely circumvented now. Time for that has passed. Paul is appealing over their heads, as is his entitlement as a Roman citizen, to be heard by Caesar. What a rebuke, actually, to Festus. Paul is in effect saying, I should be judged here at Caesar's judgment seat. But I can see I'm not going to get justice from you, Festus. You're as compromised as the last one. You're not going to see the thing clearly here, so I'm going to bypass you. Left him behind. No fair hearing that could be offered. And of course, this will be a huge frustration and a disappointment to the Jews to see Paul no longer even in the province. He's gone to Rome now, well outside of their jurisdiction and well outside of the kinds of influences that they could bring to bear. Might work on Felix and Festus, their bullying and harassment, not so likely to work in Rome and at Caesar's judgment seat there. So he got away from them. He left them disappointed. Hasn't God at times got a way there of really showing the plans of his enemies to be foolish, showing them that their efforts to undermine the church will come to nothing, they will be ruined, they will be brought to shame. He was with Paul in this particular thing. This is the way in which he is going to Rome, this appeal to Caesar. And so we can just draw a few lessons from that. One of them being this: we're not required to put up with injustice and unfair treatment. Paul was not going to be a scapegoat. He was not going to be a pawn in Festus's grander plan and objective there. Well, if it led to riots in Jerusalem, that was just going to be too bad. Paul was interested here in having the gospel properly heard and vindicated at Rome itself. And so we as Christians, not required to, in that way, be martyrs, to suffer injustice there without murmuring or complaint with the authorities that are doing this. The fact is, God has given to us here a democratic society in which we live. We have the opportunity to petition MPs and other people in authority. We have laws that we can actually use and apply to for redress. We have people in this country worried about the loss of free speech and who are willing to side with us. Why, it was something, wasn't it, just that Peter Tatchell reversed his previous support of the case against the Ashers Bakery in Northern Ireland, recognising that what this was potentially going to do was to coerce, well, homosexual people into having to support causes that they didn't agree with. And so he now sides with the MacArthur family in the Ashers case. Free speech, freedom of conscience. People actually can see the value of these things and see that much that is being done against the Christian church is in effect an effort to undermine those very important principles. We should use the rights that we have. We must believe that God has placed us here providentially in a country which has the rights and laws that it does. And there are times in which we are perfectly justified, as Paul was here, to stand up against injustice, to not allow people there to just use the church for political purposes or to accomplish some wider political end. We have a work to do, an important work. With all due respect to government, our work of gospel ministry and preaching is every bit as important as anything else that they may be attempting to do. So, Paul's masterstroke. Well, we can't appeal to Caesar in that way. Well, we appeal to some European court. Well, that's highly dubious, isn't it, in this day and this age? What judgments you'll get from them, who can say? Lynn Liddell's case didn't come off too well when it went to them. But even so, there are places, opportunities that we can use, where God may yet be pleased to have that case heard and heard well, and for an appeal there to be successful, as we trust it will be with the MacArthurs in Northern Ireland. And for the name of the Lord to be vindicated in a sceptical and unbelieving age. So the opposition, well, it never ends. But God is not asleep. He knows the work that his enemies are doing. And he is able to help us as Christians to stand up and at times be able to secure some real advantages. May he help us as our age, the society we're in, desperately needs, doesn't it, a Christian witness. May we still be able to render that service to our nation unhindered by the law and by those who would try to silence that work of the gospel. Amen.